The CBO has spoken, spoken again, actually, on healthcare. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 24th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It's taken long enough, but at long last, there is a score to be put to the health care bill that Republicans in the House of Representatives passed almost 3 weeks ago. By way of refresher here, the Congressional Budget Office said the last iteration of this plan, which it's important to remember never did get to a vote, would have resulted in 24 million more Americans without health insurance by the year 2026. We got Sarah Cliff from Vox on the phone to walk us through today's CBO score, as it's called. Hey, Sarah.
Okay.
So a couple of headline numbers here to get out of the way. How many more people would be without health insurance under this plan than under current law?
23 million is kind of the big headline number. And as you mentioned, Kai, that's really similar to the last report. You didn't really see any big policy changes. So, again, you're seeing a really big loss in coverage under the Republican plan.
What about then the second headline number, which is going to be money saved deficit reduction wise?
So that falls a little bit to $119 billion saved over the next decade.
Versus 300-and-something billion over the other
one. It's actually $150 billion in the last iteration. There have been a few scores, but the most recent CBO score was $150 billion saved. Now we're down to $119 billion.
Okay, so mostly marginal changes. If I'm Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, what am I thinking this afternoon? How am I feeling?
I don't think I'm feeling very great because this just isn't a good report for Republicans. I think the report is very similar to previous ones, except in one key way, the CBO really pushes back aggressively against some of the claims that Republicans have made about their plan. There's this one paragraph in the report where they say that people who are less healthy, and I'm reading from the report, would ultimately be unable to purchase comprehensive insurance. That's just a kind of devastating finding. It really pushes back against this idea of protecting people with pre-existing conditions.
And also the CBO uses, again, from the report, language talking about destabilizing the market.
Yeah, so this is one other thing that's new in this report. CBO estimates that 1/6 of the country would live in areas that would be destabilized because of these new waivers that exist in the Republican plan that let states opt out of protections for people with pre-existing conditions. So, you know, that would be a big change. And what CBO is saying is if you are one of those one in six people, you might not have access to affordable health insurance if you're a sicker person.
Now this thing is going to go to the Senate, and it's worth a mention here that the Senate basically is going to take this and say, thanks very much, put it in a corner and write its own bill, yeah?
Yeah, so they have their own working group. You know, I am curious to see how this lands in the Senate, if they want to get to higher coverage. But I think they really want to say, hey, that's the House bill. We're building our own thing. You know, don't throw that unpopular bill on us. We're starting from scratch. Mm-hmm.
To the issue of consumers in this economy and the purchasing of health care, the whole thing with the Republicans in the House was we have to get the premiums down. We have to get people to be able to pay for the insurance that they want to buy. This bill still does that, and the CBO has taken all that into account, right?
Yeah, so this bill does lower insurance premiums by about 15 to 20% in the near term, 10% in the long term. But, you know, the way it does that is essentially by making health insurance unaffordable for sicker Americans. So it's easy to lower health insurance when you kind of kick the sick people out of the pool. And that's kind of the trade-off you're seeing in this bill.
And it would do that basically by letting people just buy the catastrophic, right, and getting rid of or not forcing them to buy what are called essential health benefits.
Yeah, so you could apply for a waiver. A state could apply for a waiver from these essential health benefits. You could apply for waivers out of the pre-existing condition provisions. All of that just makes it a little bit harder for people who need more care to actually sign up for a health insurance plan.
The bill now firmly in the Senate's court, so to speak. Sarah Cliff, she's an editor of Vox, covers health policy for him. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
On Wall Street today, the CBO conveniently waited until after the close to offer up its score of the health care bill. But you know what? The way things have been going, traders probably wouldn't have cared anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The non-U.S. centric macroeconomic news of the day comes to us from Moody's, the credit rating people by way of Beijing. Moody's has downgraded China's sovereign debt, the first time in a generation that that's happened. But a generation's a long time, and the Chinese economy then isn't the Chinese economy now. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what's going on here.
Ask Scott Kennedy of the Center for Strategic and International Studies about the Chinese economy, and he ticks off a long list of problems.
China's economy is still highly inefficient.
Creaky old state-owned businesses are sucking up investment. Productivity is down. And then there's the debt,
which hangs out there like a dark cloud over this economy.
Kennedy says the Moody's downgrade is a signal that things could get worse in China. But then there's Andy Rothman, an investment strategist at Matthews Asia.
The timing of the Moody's downgrade is puzzling.
Rothman says the Chinese economy is great right now. The government controls the banks and the state-owned companies the banks lend to. It can cut off the loans and whittle down the debt. And Rothman says the consumer sector of China's economy is booming. Consumers are spending and
driving two-thirds of economic growth, and it's the biggest part of the economy in China now.
Then there's Arthur Krober, head of research at GavCal Dragonomics. He says, yes, China's economy has problems.
But I think there's time for them to be dealt with, and we're not facing kind of an imminent financial meltdown or a debt crisis or anything like that in the next 2 or 3 years.
Krober says the Chinese government will be able to address all of these economic issues eventually. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Today in White House budget news, a trio of Trump administration officials schlepped up to Capitol Hill to explain and defend the president's spending plan. Budget Director Mick Mulvaney was there, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin as well. Also, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, who was making her first appearance on the Hill since her not entirely smooth confirmation hearings a number of months ago. The White House wants to cut more than 30 federal education programs, shaving more than 13% off the department's overall budget, the biggest proposed cuts in education since the Reagan years. And therein, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, lies a lesson about presidential budgets and their fates once they get to Congress.
The Trump budget would cut billions of dollars for teacher development, smaller classes, and after-school programs, as well as funding for low-income college students. In today's hearing, Democratic Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut called the cuts cruel and inhumane.
And I'm going to fight this budget, Mr. Chairman, with every fiber of my body because it is wrong to do this to our kids.
I have no doubt.
She won't be the only one pushing back.
It is always difficult to cut funding in education because education funding is extremely politically popular.
Michael Petrilli is president of the Fordham Institute and favors a smaller federal role in education. But he says Democrats, independents, and even some Republicans will find it hard to make substantial cuts.
It is very easy for defenders of education spending to say that any education cuts will harm students, that they are heartless. So politicians don't like to put themselves in that situation if they don't have to.
When President Reagan tried to cut education spending by more than 35% in the midst of a recession, Congress actually increased the appropriation. President George W. Bush also met resistance. Michael Hansen with the Brookings Institution says public education has so many stakeholders, including the country's largest workforce and its powerful unions.
There are over 3 million teachers, and they tend to be relatively well engaged with the political process.
And many of the members of Congress voting on the ultimate budget will be up for re-election next year. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Online shopping is sometimes just browsing, really, right? A way to see what's out there before visiting an actual store. And until now, retailers haven't been able to connect those dots, find out what their online presence is actually getting them in the offline world, as in sales in a real store. Now comes Google with a way to make that happen and, oh, by the way, get a bigger payoff for itself, too, of course. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
Let's say I click on an online ad for yellow sandals. I resist them for a week, then head into the store and make a buy. This happens more often than you think.
Between 75 and 85% of all transactions are at least digitally influenced. So digital plays an incredibly important role in the shopping process.
Paula Rosenblum is with Retail Systems Research. Google claims its new tool can give retailers a better idea of just how much influence digital has. The search engine matches ad clicks on its site with credit card purchases made in stores. But, says Rosenblum,
will this actually give you a full understanding of that story? I don't think so.
Google relies on aggregated data and can't see an individual's name, what they bought exactly, and how much they spent. Mark Mahaney, an analyst with RBC Capital Markets, says the one who stands to benefit in the deal is Google.
The goal here is to get more offline retailers, more physical location providers, give them greater incentive to buy search ads on Google.
But all that puts shoppers at greater risk for identity theft. And then there's the whole privacy thing, says Mark Rotenberg. He's with the Electronic Privacy Information Center.
It's a slippery slope, you know, covered with ice and lubricant. I mean, the rate at which the online privacy is being diminished is beginning to accelerate.
And we barely have any left anyway. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
The president's overseas trip continues apace today. Rome this morning, Brussels, Belgium this afternoon, meetings with European leaders tomorrow, and a stop by NATO's shiny new headquarters building in the Belgian capital. Could be a little awkward, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Trump has called NATO obsolete and has described Brussels as a hellhole. The president may not get the most cordial welcome in the Belgian capital.
My guess is that there will be a little bit of nervousness given what President Trump has said about NATO in the past.
Stephen Pfeiffer of the Council of Foreign Relations says the Allies may be bracing themselves for another blast from Trump over money. Only two other allies are, like the US, hitting the NATO target and spending at least 2% of their GDP on defense.
He's been concerned about the imbalance going back to the 1980s. So this is something he believes in, and my guess is he will push it when he's meeting with allied leaders in Brussels.
The trouble is, says Nick Childs of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, we're talking very big bucks from the European point of view.
If everyone stumped up the full amount, you'd be talking about nearly $100 billion extra that countries would have to come up with.
Germany would have to spend an extra $32 billion a year, not popular in what is now a very unmilitaristic country, and this is an election year.
If Mr. Trump pushes for that in full, then that potentially makes that even more of an election issue for the Germans at the moment.
European defence spending may fall short of NATO's target, but it has been rising, mostly in response to the Russian incursion into Ukraine. But Ben Moores of IHS Markit says it may also be partly thanks to Trump, convincing Europeans they should focus more on their own defence.
We are seeing Europeans being forced to increase defence expenditure because of the erratic nature of the Trump administration.
This could be the final irony, that Trump's initial hostility to NATO and all the shenanigans over the alleged links with Russia may end up strengthening the alliance. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I elected to, at age of 48, take a leap of faith and said, I think I'll go back to college.
Turned out to be a pretty smart move. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 74 points today, 0.3% for the blue chips, closed at 21,012, neatly palindromic there. The NASDAQ up 24 points, about 0.4%, finished at 6163. The S&P 500 grew 5 points, 0.25%, 2404. We told you Google is connecting the dots between your online and offline shopping habits. The better to click up its ad revenues. Of course, Google's parent company Alphabet delivered 0.7% today. Amazon up about 0.9%. Turns out online sales are even taking the polish off of high-end jeweler Tiffany. Retailers' first quarter sales are a bit lackluster. Tiffany tarnished 0.8% today. While we're eyeing luxury brands, Christian Dior shinier by about 0.1%. Investors are poring over the Fed's meeting minutes for May, released today. We're looking for clues about Interest rates, of course, kind of a mixed message for banks. J.P. Morgan Chase, pretty much unchanged. Bank of America gave back about a 10th percent. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And you have a lot of questions for us about business and technology.
Is automation going to take over even white-collar careers?
Do we actually make enough steel to construct large-scale infrastructure projects?
What is IBM Watson?
Watson, turns out, is a supercomputer that can probably beat you at chess and might even help you with your taxes.
Want to know more? I know you do. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Bitcoin is well past $2,500 a pop today, a record high for the brand name in cryptocurrencies, and a glimpse, perhaps, of what money is in the economy of the future. Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, the CEO of a company that arguably started us on the road to a cashless society.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, PayPal CEO Dan Schulman. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Just as a place to get started and with a nod to the changes that are coming in this economy, I imagine you are now aiming this company at a totally cashless future in this society.
I think a lot of people have predicted the demise of cash, and they've frequently been wrong. But there's no question that the smartphone is leading to the digitization of money. You really now have all the power of a bank branch in the palm of your hand. And that's a tremendous benefit to be able to both speed up the time it takes to do a payment and also reduce the cost.
There's a question I usually ask CEOs, and it goes like this. What keeps you up at night? I'm going to go ahead and answer that for you because I can't imagine it's anything other than cybersecurity and getting hacked.
Yeah, so obviously cybersecurity is of the utmost importance. But one of the things that helps a lot in cybersecurity is scale. And what I mean by that is you can't just protect people through your username and your password. What you really need to have is a tremendous amount of data and information. We did over 7 billion transactions on the platform, and we take all that data and information and we run algorithms through it to basically identify behavior that's abnormal and stop that behavior.
Can't possibly protect them all, right? I mean, there is some vulnerability out there. That has to be sort of a given.
There's always some potential vulnerabilities in any system. But again, if you have a tremendous amount of data and information, and we know so much more about you, we really can look at a full digital identity around you. We look at many, many, many variables, which I won't reveal publicly, to protect you. We've had a tremendous degree of success with that.
Well, that gets actually to the whole privacy thing. And you are, I'm sure, old enough to remember when you just didn't talk about like salaries and money and how much people make. But now, first of all, you all have tremendous amounts of financial data on your clients and your customers. But you own, just for one example, Venmo, which is sort of a peer-to-peer social, you know, money transferring network where everybody can see, you know, who's paying whose babysitter and what the rent money is, you know?
90% of people who use Venmo tag their payment with some sort of comment because it is part of their social feeds. However, that tagging is entirely up to the consumer. They can turn off those feeds. They can turn on those feeds. It really is up to them. We take the privacy of our consumers' information as one of the most trusted things that people look to PayPal for, because when it comes to financial services, the single most important brand attribute you can have is trust.
All right, so let me get you back to where I started, which is this idea of inevitably, really, at some point, a cashless society. In, say, 10 years, with, as you said, the digitization of money in this economy, what does PayPal look like?
So I think if you think out over the next 10, 15 years, mobile is blurring the distinction between online and offline. And for consumers, there's a saying that it's expensive to be poor. Over 50% of the U.S. population does not have $400 of savings. And so if we can help people to do everyday transactions at a fraction of what it would cost other institutions to do that, I think that's a noble mission for us and one that we're inspired by.
Dan Shulman, he's the CEO at PayPal. Dan, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much, Kai.
The extended cut of my chat with Dan Shulman lives digitally on our Corner Office podcast. Give it a listen. While politicians do whatever it is they're going to do with healthcare, out in the actual economy, where people live and work, the changes are and have been happening for a while now. We're going to go back to Erie, Pennsylvania today for our series, The Big Promise. Now, the promises that Donald Trump made during the campaign, in this case, getting rid of Obamacare, are playing out in places that voted for him. Today, Marketplace's Erica Barris has the story of Erie's new industrial base.
Like a lot of people in Erie, Mark Bryant spent decades in manufacturing. He was an engineer at Hammer Mill Paper, which became International Paper. But then the mill closed in 2002. Bryant says some of his coworkers retired. Others?
Honestly, ended up on a bar stool somewhere, complaining how things were bad and until their benefits ran out.
And the rest did what he did.
So I elected to, at age of 48, take a leap of faith. And said, I think I'll go back to college.
Oh, there's secrets.
That was 15 years ago. Today, Bryant is a registered nurse here at UPMC Hammett, as in University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in downtown Erie. He says he occasionally runs into guys at the hospital he worked with at the paper mill. Not surprising, given that healthcare has become what manufacturing used to be, Erie's biggest industry. All you need to do is turn on the TV to be reminded of that.
I didn't choose to need a heart and double lung transplant, but I did choose UPMC.
That's an ad for Bryant's employer and one of Erie's two biggest healthcare networks. And the other one?
We are Allegheny Health Network, and you are why we're here.
Actually, Pittsburgh is why they're both here. That city, just a couple hours from Erie, helped rebuild its economy after the steel industry collapsed by doubling down on healthcare. And when those two big healthcare systems you just heard from needed to find new battlegrounds to conquer, they set their sights on Erie. Scott Whalen is CEO of St. Vincent Hospital, part of Allegheny Health Network.
In Pittsburgh, there seems to be the ongoing battle, but that really wasn't what happened here.
Maybe not at the beginning 7 years ago, but there's a full-blown medical arms race now. Each system is sinking $100 million into new construction. They're both offering new specialties. And the doctor poaching is nonstop.
Check it. Yes. Arms are checked.
Yes, everything is secure.
That's Mohammed Assad, a bariatric surgeon. Today, he's at UPMC Hammett performing weight loss surgery on a 57-year-old woman with the help of a $2 million robot. He was lured away from the hospital across town with promises of technology like this.
You go to any city of this magnitude, there will be two or three hospitals, and there will be always a competition. And that's a healthy thing, I say.
Healthy as in jobs. Together, UPMC and Allegheny employ nearly 7,000 people. And then there are medical-related jobs created by those jobs and non-medical ones, too, like construction. Paul Ginsberg is director of health policy at the Brookings Institution. He says when the big guys come and buy up the little guys, it doesn't always end well.
There's been an accumulation of research that has shown that hospital mergers raise prices in the community.
But in Erie's case, he says,
the added premiums that come from more jobs in healthcare, much of that is paid for by people outside of Erie.
People like the woman having the weight loss surgery. Erie is a big draw for out-of-towners looking for specialized medical procedures they can't get at home. And then there's that other out-of-towner, the federal government. Many Erie residents are covered by Medicaid and Medicare. But if the Republican health care bill goes through and Medicaid funding is slashed, economists say hospitals could lose those government health care dollars. Expansion plans could be scaled back along with job growth. And that could create a lot of pain in a city still trying to rebuild its economy. In Erie, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a slight shift in the center of gravity of the American banking industry. From the pages of the Charlotte Observer, this item: San Francisco has passed Charlotte, North Carolina, to take the number two spot on the list of biggest American banking cities. Charlotte has Bank of America, of course. San Francisco has Wells Fargo. Mostly, though, it's a bragging rights thing, right? New York, of course, still number one by, like, miles. Holy cow, look at the time we have got to go. The Dow up 74 points today, about 0.3%. NASDAQ up 24 points, 0.4% there. The S&P 500 grew 5 points to the good, 0.25%. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.